We're into Luke, and we're almost at the end of Luke chapter 8. Getting towards the end, we're going to finish off Luke chapter 8 today. But just to recap, Jesus has told the parable of the sower to those following him, along with the parable of the candle, which we don't often get to talk about. And he's been boosting their faith. That's what he's been doing, really. And he's told the disciples that he's going over to the other side of the lake. But as they go, a storm comes up. And while Jesus sleeps, the disciples are absolutely terrified. But basically, the storm was a test of their faith, and they failed the test miserably. Then when they got to the other side, just as Jesus says they would, Jesus is met by this demon-possessed man. And he frees him from their possession, because there were many demons in this guy. And the townspeople, they come out to see this man because they've heard of what's gone on. And they see that he's now free of demons and he's sitting at Jesus' feet. And they're more afraid of him sitting at Jesus' feet than they were when he was possessed by demons. And they ask Jesus to leave. So Jesus crosses back over the Sea of Galilee. So that's where we've got to. So as you pick it up in verse 40 of Luke chapter 8, it says this. It says, "And it came to pass that when Jesus was returned, the people gladly received him, for they were all waiting for him." Now, as we go through this, we're going to see two people with very different backgrounds and in very different situations. And the contrast here between this man and this woman is really interesting, because it shows the variety of people who came to Jesus for help. The man's name here is Jairus, but the woman is completely anonymous. Jairus was a wealthy leading citizen, but the woman was much more lowly, and she'd spent all the money she had trying to get well. And Jairus is interceding for his daughter, while the woman is hoping to get help for herself. And both came to the feet of Jesus. Jairus has been blessed with 12 years of joy with his daughter, and now he might lose her, while the woman has experienced 12 years of misery because of her affliction. And now she was hoping that Jesus might heal her and this might come to an end. So verse 41 then says this. It says, "And behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and besought him that he would come into his house, for he had one only daughter about 12 years of age, and she lay a dying. But as he went, the people thronged him." So for 12 years, Jairus' home has been filled with the joy and laughter that only a child can bring. And then tragedy struck. And this is a difficult situation. It's a difficult problem he's got, because he's a ruler of the synagogue, no less. And he's putting everything at risk here. His career, his money, his home, his family, everything he has, he's putting at risk by falling down in front of Jesus. But isn't it interesting? What does the risk matter when you're facing a life and death situation and nothing else has the answer that you need? Religion doesn't produce the answer that you need. It doesn't matter if you've read the Upanishads, which are the ancient texts of Hinduism, or if you meditate on your navel, or even if you crawl on your knees to a statue. When somebody you love is dying, religion does not have the answer. And everything in your life you thought was important, you're happy to put at risk over and above that one thing that you're longing for, that's breaking your heart. And that's what's happening in the life of Jairus right now. And as we look at this story, it isn't just making his daughter well again, it's what Jesus will do in the life of this man. And also in our lives as we go away with this passage of scripture in our hearts this morning. Jairus has everything that people could want, but he's willing to put it all at risk to bow down in front of Jesus, his last hope. And Jesus begins to go with him through the crowds now. And it says in verse 43, "And a woman having an issue of blood 12 years, which had spent all her living upon physicians, neither could be healed of any." Now, Luke's just a little bit more forgiving here, because he's a doctor, I guess. Mark, in his gospel, says that this woman saw many physicians and spent everything she had, and she was worse for it. Luke just says she saw many physicians and couldn't be healed. And you have to understand that in this day, there was a whole page in the Talmud, and it outlined a whole range of things that told you things that were prescribed for a woman with a blood flow. And this was the medicine of the day, you know. And this is why you spent your money on doctors and didn't get better, because you would have taken ostrich egg. This is one of the things that they had in there listed. You would have taken ostrich egg and burn it and take the ashes of it. And if it was summer, the woman would put them in a linen cloth. But if it was winter, she would put them in a cotton rag. And those ashes of the ostrich egg were supposed to produce a healing effect. But if that didn't work, it said that you were to take a barley seed that you were to find in the dung of a white female donkey and insert that, and that would do the trick. All of these things are listed in the Talmud, so you can understand why she spent all her money on doctors and didn't get any better. But there's a whole page of things like that prescribed for this problem. And this woman has been like this for 12 years. I mean, imagine that. And it gets worse, because when we went through the book of Leviticus together, if you remember, in chapter 15, it said that in this kind of situation, she would be placed outside of the camp because she was unclean. So she couldn't be around her husband. She couldn't be around her children. And in addition to that, anything she sat upon was unclean. And even if she touched a wall, it was defiled. And she would be kept outside the camp until the blood flow ended, and then she would offer a sin offering and a trespass offering. That's what it said. So here she is, she doesn't have any money left, and maybe it's been 12 years since she's had a hug with her parents. You know, no husband around her, and if she's had any children, it's been 12 years since she's had held them on her lap. And it's also been 12 years since people looked at her with any respect. Because, you see, on top of everything else, the Talmud said that if you had this kind of affliction, it was because there was immorality in your life and God was judging you. So this poor woman is going through absolute agony. But somehow she must have heard something about Jesus, because she's willing to come into this crowd and break all the rules. And it tells us in the other Gospels that she's saying within her heart, "If I can just touch the hem of his garment, I know that I'll be made whole." And then verse 44 says, "She came behind him and touched the border of his garment, and immediately her issue of blood stopped." She wants to touch the hem of his garment because in the book of Numbers, chapter 15, it outlined what Jewish males had to do. And I'll read it to you. You don't need to turn there. It said, "The Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel and bid them that they make fringes in the border of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of borders a ribbon of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them. And that you seek not after your own heart or your own eyes, after which you used to go a-whoring, that you may remember and do all my commandments and be holy unto your God. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God." So when this woman looked at Jesus, she just saw that ribbon of blue. And for the first time in her life, she understood, Here's a man with a connection to heaven. She saw that with Jesus, it was different. See, Jesus has already said about the Pharisees and the Sadducees in Matthew 23:5, all their works they do are for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments. Now, the phylacteries consisted of strips of parchment on which were written four specific texts. And won't go into those texts now, but they were enclosed in a square leather case, which was fastened by straps to the forehead just between the eyes. And making broad the phylacteries refers to them making the case as big as possible so as to make it look as if they were extremely holy. You know, you can imagine them having such a big case that they were bumping into each other because they couldn't see where they were going. But also they like to put these big blue borders on their garments as well in order to show everybody else how spiritual they were. But I'm sure Jesus just had a little blue border running around the bottom of his garment. And this woman looks at that and she says in her heart, this symbolizes everything that God said someone's life that's consecrated to him should be. And when she took hold of it, she didn't just touch it. The grammar gives us the idea that she took hold of it in her hand and she clenched it. She must have thought, Lord, you know, she must have seen the connection between Jesus and heaven. And by the way, people should see that when they look at us. If you're saved and you've come out of the world, the Bible says, let those who name the name of Christ depart from iniquity. So when people look at your lives, you know what? Without even saying anything, they should see a border of blue. They should see a strip of heaven somewhere in your life. They should see something about you that's different than the way you were before you became a Christian. And they should see something different about your life than the lives of the people who don't believe. And when she looked at Jesus, she saw that border on his garment and she reached out and she took hold of it. And it says, as soon as she took hold of it, she felt her blood flow stop. It came to an end. And then verse 45 says, and Jesus said, who touched me? When all denied, Peter and they that were with him said, Master, the multitude throng you and press you, and you say, who touched me? Yeah, we can always rely on Peter, can't we? But it's the other guys as well. Lord, there's 5,000 people touching you. How can you ask who touched me? And Jesus, verse 46, said, somebody has touched me, for I perceive that virtue has gone out of me. Now, Jesus says this, and she is slinking away through the crowd now. The crowd's moving with him and everybody's crowding around him and it's all heaving and moving along, and she reaches through all of this and she's alone in the crowd, and we all know, I think, how somebody can be in the middle of a crowd and still be completely lonely. And she would have been content just to slip away. But then she hears a voice behind her, who touched me? And the whole world just stops. And it says here, when all denied. So she must be seeing everyone going, oh, no, not me. No, not me. I don't know. Don't look at me. I didn't do it. And Peter and the guys are saying, what do you mean, who touched you? Everybody's touched you. And Jesus says, no, somebody's touched me because I perceive that virtue's gone out of me. So verse 47 says this. It says, and when the woman saw that she was not hid, she came trembling. And falling down before him, she declared to him before all the people for what cause she had touched him and how she was healed immediately. Now, you've got to understand, because it tells us in Mark's gospel that Jesus says, who touched me? And everybody denies doing it. And then Peter says his bit. And then Jesus turns around and looks at her and says, no, somebody's touched me because I perceive that power's gone out of me. And it's then that she realises the game's up. So that kind of helps us understand what's going on here. And let me tell you something else this morning. You can't be hidden either. Oh, you might hide from us. You may even try to hide from yourself. But the Bible says that Jesus is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And I pray this morning that he's going to say to somebody, "Who touched me? Did he touch me? Did you touch me?" I pray you did. I pray you pray that prayer, you know. Because when the woman saw that she couldn't hide from Jesus, she came trembling and falling down before him. And notice it says, she declared to him before all the people for what cause she had touched him. So she says in front of everyone that she'd sneaked in, even though she was unclean, and she broke all the rules. And she was healed immediately. So I think it's interesting to note her perspective of God here. Because I can remember before I was saved thinking that, you know, God was the big thou shalt not who lived in the sky somewhere. And if you mess with him, he chucked lightning bolts down. And it appears that she's got the same impression. She feels the healing and she knows now that she's not going to get away. And so she comes trembling and no doubt weeping as well, and she falls down in front of him. Because Leviticus has said that she had defiled the master. And in her mind, Jesus is now unclean because of her. And she's thinking, you know, if he'd known about my problem, he'd have never let me touch him. And that's interesting, you know, because there are so many around today that are just like that, aren't there? They think, oh, he won't let me near him. You know, I'll defile him. Oh, yeah, I want Jesus, but oh, man, my life is so messed up. I've got so much stuff in my heart, so much anger and so much selfishness. I could never reach out. He'd never let me touch him anyway. He's too good for the likes of me. I need to get it all together first. No. See, that's the way she thought. She thought the same thing. So she comes trembling now and she falls down in front of Jesus, and the crowd are all watching his every move to see what he's going to do. And then she tells him the whole story. 12 years ago, and poor Jairus is going, 12 years, my daughter, she's 12 years old, she's dying. And she carries on, "Master, 12 years ago this started, and I've been accused of all kinds of things. Immorality, I've been cut off, I've lived without hope. I've felt my life slowly draining away over the years, and I've spent every penny I had on doctors, and none of them made me any better." She tells the whole story, and then at the end she says, "As soon as I touched you, Master, I was healed." Now verse 48 says, "And he said to her, 'Daughter, be of good comfort. Your faith has made you whole. Go in peace.'" Now, we need to take note of this, because this is the only place in the New Testament where Jesus calls a woman daughter. And it's used in an endearing way as well. It's the word that's used for your little girl at home. It's equivalent to Jesus looking at her and saying, "Honey," or "Sweetheart." She's the only woman in the New Testament that he says that to. I mean, she probably thinks he's going to look at her and say, "You what? You were bleeding for 12 years and you touch me? Pow!" You know, but I'm sure that the one thing that this woman never forgot for the rest of her life was when Jesus, or was rather the look in the eyes of Jesus, when he said to her, "Sweetheart, sweetheart." And you know, people can't believe it when he says that to us either, can they? Now, verse 49 says, "While he yet spoke," so he was still saying those words, it says, "While he yet spoke, there came one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, 'Your daughter is dead. Trouble not the master.'" Now, I can't imagine what must be going on in Jairus' mind. I mean, he's probably thinking, she died without me being there. I wasn't even holding her hand. And not only that, I've given up everything to fall down in front of this Jesus. And what good has it done? I've put my whole career at risk. My home is on the line. I'm going to be excommunicated. Everything's just gone. And the thing I love the most, my love, my future, my little girl, this is what I get for falling down at the feet of this Jesus? Huh. Well, there's a cost to it. There's always a cost to it. But do you know what? Jairus will be thanking this woman throughout eternity for interrupting his journey. Because if Jesus had reached his house when his daughter was still alive, Jesus no doubt would have healed her. But this man, he had a much more important lesson to learn than healing, and that was resurrection. And by the time Jesus gets there, she's dead. And what happens then is way more glorious. And this woman with the blood flow would be the most blessed interrupter this man would ever have. And I tell you, you know, that's a hard lesson for me to learn too. I don't know about you, because I don't like being interrupted, you know. I kind of plan my day and get up in the morning and get it all worked out, and it's busy and I've got things to do, and boom, interruption. And I have to learn each and every day that I need to be prepared for the Lord to change my plans in order that his plans might be fulfilled. And I have to learn that each day, because I'm a slow learner. This guy hears, "Your daughter is dead, no need to trouble the master." But when Jesus heard it, verse 50, he answered him saying, "Fear not, believe only, and she shall be made whole." Now, Jairus has already just heard that, hasn't he? You know, Jesus has just said to the woman, "Daughter, be of good comfort. Don't fear. Your faith has made you whole." He's hearing the same kind of phrases. And the thing is, you know, as we look at this, how willing are we to hear his voice when we're under the huge pressures that we sometimes have? And he says to us, "Look at me. Keep your eyes on me. Don't be afraid." And the amazing thing is that he doesn't have to depend on us for that to happen, does he? So Jesus spins around and he looks at Jairus and he says, "Don't be afraid. Just believe. She's going to be okay. She's going to be made whole." And when he came into the house, he suffered no man to go in save Peter and James and John and the father and mother of the maiden. And all wept and bewailed her. But he said, "Weep not, she's not dead, but sleeping." And they laughed him to scorn, knowing that she was dead. Now, by the way, to Jesus, she was sleeping. Because he's going to tell her to get up and she's going to get back up again. And it's just the same with all of us, isn't it? In the New Testament, when the Bible talks about the death of a believer, it refers to our physical bodies as sleeping, because he's going to tell all of us to get up. It doesn't matter whether it's an hour like here or 2,000 years or whatever, because as far as he's concerned, you're just sleeping. And when he tells you to get up, you're getting up. It's going to be the most wonderful alarm clock in the history of mankind. Get up. Now, look, just to explain these verses, it tells us in Mark that there are also professional mourners here that kind of sneak in, and it was their job to be wailing and mourning. And the more money you had, the more mourners you had. And these guys, I mean, they're professionals. This is what they do. And they follow Jesus in doing their stuff. And when Jesus says she's just sleeping, they start to laugh at him and scorn him. Because this is putting their jobs on the line. And they don't like that idea one little bit. So verse 54 says, "And he put them all out and took her by the hand and called, saying, 'Maid, arise.' and her spirit came again, and she arose straightway, and he commanded to give her meat. And her parents were astonished, but he charged them that they should tell no man what was done. Bit of a job trying to keep that quiet, I would think. But you know, I think it's interesting that Jairus and this girl's mum, they didn't have huge faith, so they were astonished when they saw what happened. And I don't know about you, but this kind of helps me understand that although faith is the currency of heaven or eternity, all it takes is faith the size of a grain of mustard seed, which by all accounts was half the size of a grain of sand, to make things happen. So I think this tells us that we should all expect the Lord to work, even as we take a baby step of faith. And as he did with Jairus, he will meet you there. He'll meet you where you are, because we have a great God. Let's bow our hearts to pray.